This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
Hello, is this on? Hello and welcome to Why Food, a
this
podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers in food and beverage. Does it sound weird?
I can hear you. You're okay.
Are we good? Okay.
Yeah.
Today we are graced with an awesome guest. Her name is Zwan Graze, and she's giving me a weird look. She is the wine director at Olmsted, which is maybe the trendiest restaurant in Brooklyn at the moment.
There's no maybe.
Definitely. Restaurant in Brooklyn. Zwan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Zwan, you started in retail wine before moving into your position as a somm and then now a wine director. Can you tell us a little bit about that aha moment you had while starting to drink wine, learn more about it, when you realized like you want to be in restaurants, you want to be serving wine to people?
Yes, I think it was always a serving of wine to people. It's just a matter of like that format. So retail was one thing. It was definitely something that was, you know, in conjunction with this journalism job that I had. So it just kind of filled in the gap financially for these New York prices that we pay. So it wasn't until I worked in a restaurant that I was actually like, there's no going back. There's no going back to retail unless you're just tired of working on the restaurant floor. And I mean, that also happens. I'm not there yet, but it's inevitable.
And tell us a little bit about your first career in journalism. You worked for People Magazine.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was great. It was the time of my life. I did an internship. They had us up at Columbia University. We were at the Time Warner building 5 days a week, like a regular job. And I kind of like lucked out and got that internship, but it was great because it was my first time in New York and my first time extensively. So it wasn't just like a weekend or like a little vacation. We were here for the entire summer, exploring the city and like being young and like writing and going on all these different like, I don't know, events to cover and very celebrity driven, of course. And it was great. It was great. And then after that, I went and worked for People Magazine in Miami, which actually was like probably one of the best times of my life. I was in band throughout college. Like,
what instrument do you play?
French horn.
Wow.
Yes. The most
beautiful instrument. Do
you still play? No, I don't. I don't play, unfortunately. But I just need to get my instrument and get back in. But
yeah,
that's down the line.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about the first time that you ever tasted wine as a kid, or when was that?
You know what? My very first taste of wine was as a kid. I had to have been maybe like, I don't know, between eight and 11. But my mom had it as like medicine for like blood pressure. I'll just go ahead and clear that up. So she would have red wine in the house. And I remember just being like, oh my God, there's wine in the house, because we did not drink. We were like Southern Baptist hard, for real. And it just wasn't a thing. It was not a thing. It was like frowned upon, and it just wasn't in our house. It still isn't in their house to this day. But growing up, she did have it for medicinal purposes. And I remember just being like, I want to taste it. And she was like, no, this is grown folks stuff. This is not for kids. And then one day I finally probably asked one too many times. She let me taste it. And it was awful. I found it. And it probably was awful wine, because someone who doesn't drink and is doing this strictly for medicinal purposes isn't going out looking for like the best producer. Let's be honest.
Sure.
So that was my very first taste. And I never thought twice about it after that, really, until it became my entire life.
And you mentioned at one of the retail stores that you're working at, you had like a really transformative relationship with some of the owners, and they would cook and you would drink, and that's when you really started like seeing it as more of a lifestyle. Can you tell us more about that?
Repeat the first part.
At one of the wine stores you were working at.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. So I had the great joy of working at a number of great shops. the first one was Discovery Wines when it first opened, and it was a big, huge store, and they had like a little kiosk. You can like scan the label and get all this information on a screen, and it was like, you know, moving the consumer into more information, which I thought was really cool. After that, I did Harlem Vintage in Harlem, so black owned and operated. I was very happy about that. JJ and Lee Campbell were there, and that was a great moment as well. And then I went on to work for Thirst Wine Merchants, where I think it became, at that point, it was, I was in it enough to be receptive to what Thirst had to offer. And what that shop had to offer, I was working under, my manager at the time was Mike DeCruz, and another manager, Ariana Rolich, who is fresh out of Chamber Street. But being there is where it became very much a producer-driven experience for me, where it's like, these are the producers that you need to be drinking. These are the importers that are bringing these wines in that matter to this particular store. So when you're under that and you're like in the presence of these people who can speak extensively about not just wine in general, but about the people who are actually making the wine, I was very much intrigued and thirsty for all this information that they were just freely giving. And we also would like go. We were right off of Carlton and DeKalb in Fort Greene. Romans was up the street. We worked together every Sunday, and every Sunday we would like pull bottles, go to Romans, drink. And it was Thirst and that community, actually, those two people specifically, that made it something beyond work and more lifestyle driven. So we would eat, we would drink, we would talk about it, we would have the wine with food. It wasn't just take the bottle home and open it and drink it over a couple of days. Like we had full experiences at Romans, which is how it all began, and then into their own personal homes and into their own private collections of wines, and lots of laptops came out and we would like Google things. And
so what was the most kind of surprising wine that you tasted at that point, or a type of wine that you had just never encountered before?
Yeah, Puro, which is a natural sparkling rosé. So at the time we decided to do this because there's a whole thing of how you're going to open up this bottle and more or less disgorge this sediment at the top out and then drink the wine. So we did it, and we like said, this is what we're going to do. And so we like planned the day around it. And another friend of mine, Zachary Sussman, was hanging out with us at the time. And he may have brought it someone else that I really don't know. But either way, you have it turned upside down in, if I remember correctly, like a bucket of ice water. And you ease it out. It pops and more or less explodes in the water. And then you drink it. That was probably one of the...
Is that the normal way to do such a thing?
For this particular bottle, it is. Okay. Why escapes me at the moment, to be honest. I think more or less you just want to get the sediment out.
Okay.
And that's the best way to do it. But at the time, I was just like, what is this? What is going on? But it was actually a real thing. And it was something that we taped and recorded and something that they had wanted to do for a long time. It's almost like savoring a bottle of champagne for the first time. That was the first time it was like... We're getting together to specifically open and go through the ceremony of opening this bottle of wine. It was super cool, and the wine was delicious.
How were you able to develop your wine vocabulary since you hadn't been interested in before, but now that you've been around it and drinking it? Like, I know a lot of people who are relatively new to wine, that's always so intimidating, the terms that people use. How did you kind of find your own voice and how you describe wine and how you, you're thinking to yourself, like, what this tastes like to me?
I think those things kind of develop the more you drink and the more you like write things down. So like the taking of notes helped a lot because you don't want to see the same sentence over and over again, and you shouldn't from whatever you taste. So the more I started like writing notes at tastings and taking down notes from, again, wine friends who had something great to share, started it. So at least you're like writing something. At least you're like expressing a thought into a complete sentence. And then from there, I think the flavors just become real. So you know if something is soft fruit or crunchy fruit or acidic or a little bit of residual sugar, if there's something faulty. All these things just accumulate, I guess, in your palate, and then you're able to kind of express it. Sometimes there are things I can't express, and I don't really know. You just pull from whatever happens to make sense, and you compare it to something that you can kind of, like, say immediately that comes to mind. But
are there times where someone else's soft fruit is not your soft fruit, and how do you...
Yeah, there are times when people are like, this is sweet, and there is no sugar at all. There are times when there's fruit expression, and it comes out as sugar to a palate. I mean, sometimes I will say...
you're just wrong about that.
Situations, you know, pending. Sometimes I just can't care. And it's like, whatever. You tell me, and we're going to go from there, because I'm going to get you what you want to drink. That is the complete and utter objective. But yeah, there are times when you see it one way and someone sees it another way, or they taste it a different way. And then at that point, you're like, okay, well, let's come back to the top of the conversation.
Yeah.
And you tell me what it is in this that is either turning you off or something that makes you not want to drink it. And then, you know, there's always something that we can get.
Yep.
There's always something to get. Adjectives aside.
Like, so as a wine expert dealing with a general public that may or may not be very well educated, what advice do you have for somebody going to a restaurant who wants to order wine, or what are some of the, I don't know, you have those conversations 100 times a night. So how do you like those conversations to go, and how do you find them to be most productive for your customers?
Yeah, I think the most productive way is just comfortability. So I hope to approach the table or the bar or the guests in kind. Like, I am totally here to get you what you want, and we can talk about it. So I think once that initial, that immediate first impression is, like, melted away and we know we're cool, people will open up, and they will, even if they have no, like we talked about, verbiage about what they might want in particular, they do have an idea of either what they want or what they don't want. So they will either tell me about a wine, they will say, I like Pinot, I like Sancerre. Mm-hmm. From there, we can go, that gives me a great, clear, and direct avenue. And then I can say, do you want a light red, or do you want to do a white? You want a full white, light white? And then these are the nitpicky things. And then from there, we can go into, like, this producer, I think, is great. What he's doing is this. The wine tastes like this. And we go through maybe three of those, and then they'll say, I actually really like the second one. The second one always...
It's like option C.
The second bottle always sells.
Right.
But it's also what they hear me sound excited about. They'll ask me, what are you excited about? What are you feeling? Because sometimes they don't want to even have the conversation of what they think they might like or might not like. So
they want you to
push it in my hands. They want me to push them a little bit. And they will let me know. And people who don't want to be pushed will also let me know. They will tell me, I don't want any funk in my wine. I want it clean. Like this. And then the people who will just kind of let you, you know, curate that experience for them. So both are totally fine. One is just more fun than the other, but both are fine.
And you have a list that's got to be a couple hundred bottles long. How do you keep all of that straight? How do you know when somebody comes in and says, I mean, especially when you're talking about very broad categories, I want a light red or whatever it is. You've got to have 50 or 60 wines at least that
yeah
would fit.
Yes. So first off, I believe in every wine that's on that list. So your personality helps me also think about what I can give you or what you might like. Attire, fashion, quirkiness, conservativeness. Mm-hmm. I'm reading that guest, like, while we're talking.
Yeah.
And as that conversation goes on, they will confirm some things or not confirm some things. And so I also know I'm not going to push anything that might be a little too off the beaten path unless you tell me you can take it or unless we've, like, established that. Otherwise, it's going to be something delicious. It just might not be the most interesting thing. I just put on the list a skin contact section. And
what's a skin contact section?
So a skin contact section is where you would have sparkling, white, rosé. It's what we have coined orange wine. Really what it is, it could be any manner of colors, but the skin contact part of it just comes from these white grapes or Pinot Gris gray grape having a longer time in the wine maceration so that you now have this extracted color and a little bit more tannic structure.
That comes from the skin having been in contact with the juice for longer.
Exactly. Okay. As opposed to just a fresh, free-run white wine. And people are really into that because they know, they're like, is skin contact orange wine? And it's like, yes, more or less. And that section has gotten the most attention than anything else on that list. And we had them kind of like scattered throughout the list under their respective country. But now that they're all together, people, they gravitate towards it. And so I think that's really cool too, because they know it exists. It's here in plain sight and they can drink it and have an experience with it. And
why do you think orange wine became such a thing?
I think that's like any trendy thing. I think rosé was probably at the forefront of that, where it had a negative connotation. Riesling, also negative connotation. Mm-hmm. And it took wine professionals, for lack of a better phrase, to stand behind these things that we know are delicious and great and can be not a one-note thing. Rosé is not just sweet. Riesling is not just sweet. Orange wine is not just funky. So these things have these like negative connotation to them. And I think once you have them out for people to see and for people to taste, they can kind of go from there. But it really is a matter of just kind of like peeling away the negative thoughts about these wines and having people be open to drinking them. And then they can make their own opinion from there.
Follow-up question. Do you think Merlot will ever recover?
Maybe. I hope so.
Yeah.
I don't ever want anything to be like discredited because of some one-off opinion. But things have to be made properly, you know, to be enjoyed. I don't think Merlot's ever going to go away because it's one of those great safety nets in the grand global drinking culture of it all, not just our little beautiful bubble here that we have in the wine world. But people drink what they want to drink. And if you go to a grocery store and you buy your wine at the grocery store, you're going to buy what you buy. And that's a different type of consumer. It's almost like I drink Johnny Walker Black. I am a Grey Goose drinker. There are people who have what they drink and that's it. I mean, that's just what that is. It's not for me to argue, but it is. It's also, I can't help that person.
Yeah.
What are some of the other trends you see in wine right now that you're really excited about?
Lots and lots of pet nat.
What's that?
What's that?
Oh, so it's
a sparkling
wine that the second fermentation happens in the bottle. So it's one of those things where it can be, it's an unpredictable thing because you have no control, really, over what's going to happen. But for the most part, you get this beautiful kind of raw, sparkling wine that is super fun to drink.
And maybe a little funky or...
A little bit. A lot of them are on the cloudier side of things. Some are a little bit more cleaned up. But for the most part, they're just really fun to drink.
Do you have to open them in the same crazy way that you were saying earlier?
No. A lot of them are bottle caps.
Now Jenny wants to open all of her wine like that.
I know. It was fun. That was a great memory. I will never forget that. We took pictures. But if you go to a shop and you ask for a pet nat, you're gonna be fine. It's most of the time it drinks like a really cool soda that you can just kind of drink from the bottle.
And what about trends on the producer's side? Are there? I mean, you mentioned when we were talking over lunch about the 40 under 40. Is that what it was? The new producers in wine?
Yes. Yeah. So 40 under 40 this year was really cool to look through because it actually had a lot of color. It was like a lot more diverse.
Not talking about red and white.
I'm not talking about red wine.
There was a little dance there.
So it was really cool to flip those pages and see people of color. I mean, yeah. Straight up. So that's exciting. I don't know if that's necessarily a trend.
These are producers, or
some are wine professionals, retail shop curators and owners. One winemaker I had the great pleasure of meeting, Krista Scruggs out of Vermont, making wine out of Vermont, and who will be making wine out of Texas.
Interesting.
Which is where I'm from, so it's all very exciting. Black woman, let me say that. Killing it, doing it. So the trend may then be that what someone in wine is, what they do, what they look like, is diversifying day by day. It is of interest to a lot of people, and, you know, I remember I was working at a restaurant one day, and a guy was talking to his server, and it wasn't me who was doing the wine service, but they're like, oh, that was a Somme? He didn't look like a Somme. And our server immediately was like, well, what does a Somme look like?
Yeah, good question.
And they had nothing to say, of course, in return. Like, no. But he did say that. Mm-hmm. He didn't look like a Somme. Well, what does a Somme look like? I don't know.
Yeah.
And no one can say what that is. There is a traditional, stereotypical image that we might conjure up. But today, it's not that. It's not that anymore. So that's exciting.
Yeah.
And I hope that continues. And I know that it will. I trust that totally.
Speaking of going into becoming a sommelier, can you talk to us about that process of, A, wanting to be a sommelier, and also just starting to think like, okay, I'm going to go into the world of serving at restaurants. What kind of restaurants versus wine bars, and also the differences in kind of curating that wine list?
Yeah, it was all kind of like a natural progression. From retail. So again, post-journalism, Miami Bureau, I was working in the Miami Bureau for People Magazine. That bureau closed. And because of the internship, I thought, well, I'm just going to go back to New York and work for People Magazine. Didn't work out that way because they weren't hiring like that. Either way, they did give me a freelance position. So that was kind of cool. But at the same time, it just wasn't sustainable financially. So retail job comes in. Again, not really the most high-paying position you can possibly have. So I kind of knew I was going to need some more money to survive. And a friend of mine was a elementary school teacher, and she got a summer job at Boulay restaurant back in the day when it was the red room and the white room and the apples in the front and all that beautiful classic French Boulay ness. And working there was really cool because it was totally different. Everybody loves to eat. Everybody loves beautiful food and like a beautiful dining experience. But on the other side of that, it was like a lot of hard work and a level of seriousness that I wasn't quite expecting. I was totally just running food at the time. And there was Olivier Dufault, who was the wine director, and Mike Madrigal, who's now gone off to great success. Who I was working under. So they kind of knew I was in retail and like had an interest in wine, and they would like have conversations with me and let me taste things. And that was really cool too. But I still never knew that I would be here when I was there because I still wasn't quite ready to leave journalism. And, you know, I'm still, you know, fairly new out of college. And I was like, I'm not gonna not write.
Yeah.
However, one thing led to another and the restaurants became very fun. And once Boulay was done, I went into some wine bars and then back into restaurants and then left retail altogether. But the restaurant, the pacing of things was super cool, and the amount of things you can taste in a moment and the energy of a dining room and like the floor and like the setup and the breakdown and like your crew of people that you work with captured my interest. It still does to this day. But the wine bar life and the restaurant life are a little bit different because, like, when I was coming up through terroir, you have a very deep, extensive list, and there are lots of things to pull from. We talk about my list now, which compared to that is like peanuts. But by the glass was deep, by the bottle was deep, and things were open.
How many bottles and glasses would be more average at a wine bar?
I guess it depends. At Terroir, we were pouring about, I'm going to say about 20.
By the glass.
By the glass.
Wow.
If my memory serves me correctly.
And now how many do you?
Right now by the glass, I have like five. Okay. I have five whites, five reds, a rosé, two sparkling. But, you know, that's dinner. You know, wine bar, you can kind of have a half glass pour and like you're there to experience these wines. Restaurants is a little bit more food focused.
Yeah.
And then you're going to kind of like accessorize that experience from this set menu as opposed to maybe we'll have some snacks and a couple glasses and like dig in this wine list. You're there for the food at the restaurants and you're there for the wine at the wine bar. So where you can go with that as far as like how many labels you can have differs a lot. But there are also restaurants that have very deep lists and reserve lists. We're not one of those yet. But from what we have, I think it's still, there's a lot to offer, which is great.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in 2 minutes with Zwan Grays, the wine director at Olmsted.
Are we getting music?
I don't know.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
And welcome back. This is Why Food Podcast. We're here with Zwan Grays, the wine director at Olmsted. We were just talking about pairing wine and food, so we'll continue on that thought. Can you tell us more about your process of how do you get the make sure that the wine complements the food, but also can stand on its own at a restaurant since you can't exactly change the menu, but also want to make sure that people can kind of order whatever off the menu and make sure that they always have a very consistent wine experience?
Yeah, so that's the job. That's why I'm there. So for the most part, it starts when I'm tasting the wine with whoever is tasting me on the wine before I taste you on the wine. So I sit and have appointments with wine importers or reps for importers. And what they're going to do is they're going to say, this is what I have in the bag today. Do you want to taste? Which is my entire morning sorting through that. But either way.
It's a tough job.
So hard. Actually, not for nothing, though.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people to get back to and not a lot of time. Either way, when you make an appointment, that person's going to bring you either what they have or they're going to bring you what you want to taste because maybe a new vintage landed or some producer's son is now taking over and so they have that wine in the bag or whatever is new or something old and tried and true, whatever. And then you say, yes, I'm going to taste. Or you say, no, I cannot. But when you do, most of the time, they know you. They know your food. You've had a conversation with them. And they can bring you things that kind of might be of interest to you. For me, at that point, it is knowing the menu, which is not, you know, it's a set. That's the menu. Everything should complement that menu. Like I said, the great accessory to this meal is the wine. So knowing the food, knowing Chef Greg's ethos and his style helps me to know what wine is going to make sense on this list. There might be things on there that I want in my own personal cellar that might not work on that list. Mm-hmm. So that's not going on the list. What goes on the list is what's going to go with that food, period. That being said, it's more of a fish-driven restaurant. It's a little bit more lighter fare. There's not a lot of, like, heavy meat-driven dishes, although we do have meat dishes on the menu. But even those aren't, you know, heavy, brazy, full red wine types of traditional pairing dishes. So basically, I'm going to taste the wine. It's going to either make sense or not make sense on the list. And then whatever we decide to choose should go with the food. It just is now about your palate. Do you want red? Do you want white? Do you want full white, fresh mineral, full red, crunchy red? Either way, there's something on there that's going to make sense. And even the full reds tend to go with the food. And the good thing about people who like to eat out or who have no problems expressing thought at the table will say, we're having this. They'll remember kind of what they had, or the server will tell me. And they might, there might be a section or a dish that they really want to pair it with. For the most part, it's like those main courses, which they feel is what matters. But I want them to drink wine throughout their entire meal and enjoy it. And I want it to be a great lift to every bite of food that they have.
What do you do if someone orders something that you think might be maybe not the best pairing?
Again, situation depending. I might suggest something else that I think would be in that vein but might read better with what they're having. Or, again, always reading the guest. If they seem like the type of person that is straight up, this is what I want, no questions asked, then that's what they're going to get. And they'll be happy and I'll be happy. So, really, it's a win-win. But most of the time, people are kind of, they kind of like, they know you're there to help them get the best possible experience. So they're open. They're very open to me having a conversation and choosing something and, you know, them liking it.
What has been your personality for the wine list? Of course, you're complimenting the food, but like any things that you feel like over the years you've developed a specific tone that you take towards the wine list?
Yeah. I personally like more acidic driven whites and light, crunchy, nuanced reds.
What's crunchy?
Oh, sorry. I just mean like snappy fruited. Like, let's say you have like a crunchy skinned fruit, something that's like a little bit tart.
Okay.
A crunchy skinned cherry. Something that's going to give you a little bit of burst, but also some acidity and some like grip. Plums will do that. Cherries will do that. It's just, I guess when I say, I just mean more snappy, more acidic, okay. A little bit fresher, high toned.
What would be the opposite of that?
Stewed fruit, mm-hmm. rhubarb, mm-hmm. earth, soft tannins, older wines that have relaxed a little bit, full whites. Things that are softer on the palate, things that aren't, I guess, hopefully there's some acidity in the wine, but that also is kind of like rounded out. A little bit more weight would be the opposite, I think.
But you prefer a snappier.
Crunchier. Yeah. We're learning all these great words.
yeah, crunchier. I like that word.
I do. You know, there's a time and place. I mean, it's, you know, we'll see like when fall hits and it's actually cold out. But a good roast chicken and like a white roan, like a nice full white, is probably one of the most romantic things I can eat. A beautiful braised lamb shank and some beautiful full old red, also pure romance, and I'm totally into that, but that's just not my everyday. Not my everyday, but I'm into that as well.
You've also brought natural wines kind of to the forefront of your current list. Can you tell us a little bit about what a natural wine is, how it compares to a lot of the other terms that are floating around, biodynamic or
sulfite free.
Dun, dun, dun.
Right. Like what does it all mean?
Ooh, we venture into this great debate. I support natural wine 100% to 200%. I love it. I enjoy it. It is something that changed. I probably wouldn't even be here now if it weren't for developing an interest in natural wine, which that verbiage may change or not. But whatever comes to mind when you hear natural wine, regardless, the process that those wines go through, I believe in and I support. Of course, you want a great product in the bottle without flaw. And I think that's been the great catch. People hear natural and they think it's a flavor profile when really it's a practice.
Mm-hmm. So what is it? What's the practice?
So for the most part, you are not spraying with any chemicals or...
Spraying the grapes themselves.
Exactly, yeah. Chemical-free, low intervention, naturally occurring wines. Yeast.
So there's no added yeast.
Right, exactly.
So it's just the yeast that's naturally on the skin of the grapes when they make they press the juice.
Yes, yeah, that was it for a while, and then you know, nothing. There were wines that were very flawed back in the day when we first started drinking these natural wines, but even as palates change over time, winemaking changes over time too. So there are producers who I probably wouldn't even drink because I was like, those wines, I did not enjoy them. Mm-hmm. I found them to have these flaws. It was not well made. It wasn't clean. I'm not into it. And then I'll go back and revisit that wine now, 8 years later, all these vintages later, and you're like, oh my God, they've cleaned up because they know better. What that is a clean vineyard. It's a very clean cellar and
clean
winemaking
as in
process.
Like not dirty. Clean as in
not dirty.
Okay. This isn't another crazy wine word. It just means they keep the grapes clean.
You work clean, because at the end of the day, for a while it was like this debate: sulfur, no sulfur. And I think, you know, it's all personal preference. If you decide to put some sulfur in your wine, that's your choice. You're the winemaker. If you don't, then again, your choice. We'll see what that wine does.
What does it do to the wine?
It just sustains it, basically. It keeps it from falling apart.
How does sulfur get added to the wine?
You can add it in spraying. You could add it at bottling, which is what most people do. They'll do a little bit at bottling.
Like a little bit of gas, or what form does it take?
You know what? I really don't know the actual form of how you're adding the sulfur to the wine. But I will find out. I should know that. But I don't. I'll be honest. Either way, it gets into that wine. And it's not necessarily this awful bad thing. I mean, but that is the question. But sulfur does not hurt. It doesn't hurt the wine.
So why are people hesitant?
Because when you do add the sulfur at that point, you're like, is this wine natural? Is it completely... It's in its natural state. And that's it.
Is organic then a subsection of natural?
Yes. So they all kind of, like, natural's like the great broad stroke.
Okay.
And then you have organic and you have biodynamic, which is like completely, you in it.
Yeah. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So basically, I liken it to like a religion.
Biodynamic wines.
Yeah, I think not so much for the consumer, but for the winemaker. Again, we think about natural, organic, biodynamic. It's all a practice. This is just a practice that's a little bit deeper. You, in most cases, are following some type of lunar calendar. You're picking under a certain moon phase. You're harvesting under a certain moon phase. You're planting under a certain phase of the moon. There are preparations that are made that you do to the soil. And, like, it is a very far-reaching practice. But it's one that, you know, we believe matters to that wine and makes that wine all the more vibrant and all the more beautiful and all the more alive. Again, every palate is different. You might taste it and be like, I don't get it. Mm-hmm. I don't get why you did all this. But those wines do tend to taste a little bit more electric and a little bit more vibrant.
So you get it. Other people don't, maybe, but you.
I think.
So if somebody,
I think people get it. I think you can taste it. You can totally taste it.
And the lunar calendar, it's like changes every month, and then it changes every year as well.
Yeah, and I honestly haven't like studied what that is. There's like I don't know, but I know that
it's a lot.
Whoever is planting this way is following it to the letter. People will play like music.
Oh, really? For the vines.
It's just like this is a living organism. It is a thing. The wine is alive. The grapes are alive. The vines are alive. We're alive. So it's just a matter of like keeping that live vibrancy very present until the point where you have it in your body.
What are some of the kind of examples of that type of wine? If I wanted to go out and taste biodynamic wine, how would I go about doing that? Or what producers would I look for?
Well, there are a few. There are quite a few. I would say, I think it was Abatucci from Corsica who was playing like, as you're talking about music, playing Corsican chants to the vines that he believed that the vines responded to. Because that sound is of these people. These people are of this land. This land is what my grapes are growing out of, and it's all like this cyclical thing.
It's a terroir.
Exactly. That's one. There are a lot. I think as far as full-on biodynamics.
Or just sort of some wines in this category, natural, organic, biodynamic.
Yeah, okay. Nicholas Cameron. You just want to hear some of my favorites.
Yeah, some of your favorites. Or even just guidance on how to buy wine at a wine store, what to look for on a label that would indicate this kind of attention and care.
Yeah. All right. So what would indicate that would then be that the back label of that wine. So that's going to represent who is importing these wines. And then from there, if you know what that person who's importing the wines are about, you're going to know exactly what these wines are about. Camille, Fifi, Jenny and Francois, Bowler.
These are names of importers?
Names of importers, okay. Yeah. Zebro Vine, of course, can't not say that.
So would you say I think it's like many people that do not intuitively think of learning about importers when they are trying to find quality wine. Would you say that's like a good place to actually start if you're a new wine drinker?
Yes. Because it just, it alleviates the guessing because you know what they're already about. Like, you're not going to turn a bottle of wine over and see the list of ingredients. Like, it's not on the back. Everything that we consume has how many grams of sugar, sodium, calories, whatever. Wine doesn't have that. And so one doesn't know what's in that bottle. When we really care about everything else that we put into our bodies, for the most part. But these, the people who are importing, just a few of those names, and there are many more, who do care, and they do understand that when they go and visit France or Italy, Spain, throughout the United States, that they are representing a winemaker who is farming in a way that we believe in as far as a natural wine appreciator. Is that a word, appreciator?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So that narrows it down. And then on top of that, you really get some super fun producers, and you can, like, again, Google their story and get all the information that you might want to know about their vineyards or their family lineage or how they got into wine. And then it makes the drinking all the more enjoyable because you now have a story and it's most of the time something super cool and it just makes the wine taste better.
Do you feel like the producer lineup in the US has started to change because of where wine regions are with the climate and the changes in the wine regions? Are you seeing producers from different areas that weren't historically popular before or more diverse sets of producers?
Yeah, I think there are regions that, I think in wine, there's always this like ebb and flow. There's always this pendulum swinging one way and then it swings back the other way. As far as regions, I just got some wine on from Texas, South Hope Farm. They were local in Long Island, and now they're in Texas. And so people see that in the list, and we'll order it simply because
right.
it's from Texas, which is cool. And I'm glad it's there, and I'm glad that Texas is representing. I'm starting to see Greece, Australia kind of pop up a little bit more. I had the great pleasure of going to Greece and traveling throughout Greece and tasting wines from producers there, some old, some young, and just getting a re-education on that and just kind of like seeing it in a new light outside of like Santorini and like fresh whites. Mm-hmm. It was just a great breadth of orange wines and of pet nats and beautiful reds and things that I didn't even know existed. Australia's kind of in the same boat. Might take a little longer. But at the same time, people are bringing in Australian wines. People in Australia, I don't know if that has anything to do with climate, but they're kind of changing the way they're making wine so that it's not this big, heavy, wet blanket on your palate, but also has some lift and some freshness. Where else? Georgia. I'm feeling Georgian
wines. The
country
or the state?
The country.
Okay.
The country. My sister lives in Georgia. I'm like, y'all got some Georgia wine. ATS shot. Those are really cool too because they're odd grapes. And so you get to taste what a Georgian terroir is. And that's exciting. And then they have great classic orange wines out of M4 they've been making for eons, forever.
What about Croatia? I've been hearing all this stuff about Croatian wines.
Yeah, same situation. Yeah. Okay. I don't have any Croatian wines on the list right now, but definitely on the radar. Definitely on the radar. Drink them. I'm going to say, just for that, I should go buy a bottle of Croatian wine today. Yep. Just for that. Yeah, but there are a lot of regions. I mean, you're always going to have, like, France. In fact, at work, people tend to... France is, like, number one. Like, they want French white, or they want French red.
Yeah,
you can kind of push them, or they might actually say Italy, Spain. But for the most part, France is still like that workhorse for what people know is good to drink.
Yeah.
But there are all the other places, United States included. California's showing up, showing out a little bit. Texas, of course, yep. Oregon.
I want to try this Willamette. Texas wine now.
Yeah,
you got to come to Olmsted. I have three.
Speaking of which, where can people find you and follow your work and taste
come
some of the
taste
wines
your
that
wine.
You like?
Yeah, we are at 659 Vanderbilt, right close to Prospect Park. So, Brooklyn, if that wasn't clear. It's a great location. Vanderbilt's kind of like becoming this great little block or a stretch of space where you can shop and eat and drink very well. But that's where I am, four nights a week, sometimes five.
And where should people find you online?
Well, I mean, I have an Instagram account. It's just Zwan G, but...
Zwan, Z-W-A-N-N?
Yeah, and the letter G for Grays. It's not... You know, I could do better.
We could all do better.
Yeah, we can always do better.
But it does exist, so yeah.
All right, Zwan, it's been a pleasure having you here and talking and learning all of this stuff about wine. Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
I'm
so
Ethan Frisch, and you can find me on Instagram at via my spice company at Burlap and Barrel.
I'm Jenny Dorsey. You can always find me at Chef Jenny Dorsey, and you can find us at Why Food Podcast. If you have questions, comments, nominations, please email us whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks, and see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Well, that's history of mine.